So with that, I will start the first session, which is going to cover the catastrophic risks. So the first speaker of today is Dr. Mark Leonard. Dr. Mark Leonard joined Geoscience Australia in 1996, having obtained a degree in geophysics from the University of Adelaide and a PhD at ANU. During his GA career, Geoscience Australia, he has monitored nuclear explosions, developed seismic analysis software, designed infrasound arrays, managed the seismic network and the Australian Earthquake Alert Service. He was intensely involved in the response to the 2014 Indian Ocean tsunami, co-designed the Australian Tsunami Warning Service, the ATWS, and he represents Australia as an expert seismologist on the Indian Ocean TWS governing body. Current research includes the seismicity of Australia, the location and source parameters of Australian earthquakes, earthquake scaling, estimating maximum magnitude, and seismic tectonic model based on seismicity, geodesy, and neotectonics. There's no paleotempestology in here or phragmagmatics, thankfully. In the last couple of years, he's been the key developer of the 2013 Australian National Seismic Hazard Map. Please welcome Dr. Mark Leonard.
Good morning. So I'm here to talk to you a little bit about the seismic hazard in Australia. I understand last year someone from Geoscience Australia talked to you about the actual new hazard map we've produced. I'm not actually talking about the hazard map today very much at all. I'm sort of talking more about the uncertainties in that hazard map, just sort of trying to give you a flavour of the sort of the real uncertainties we have in putting together such a hazard map from Australia. And then the second half of the talk, I'm just going to talk a little bit about the current thinking we have on where in Australia you're most likely to get, which cities in Australia are most likely to get, you know, very large earthquakes underneath them. The second half is sort of quite speculative, but I think it might be of interest to this audience. So that's what I just said. Australia, everybody knows, you know, lots of earthquakes. And on sort of this sort of global scale where you only plot magnitude 6 and above earthquakes, Australia's relatively quiet. One thing I would point out, and these maps can be very deceptive, is actually not many of these earthquakes, even around the Pacific, are actually on land. They're actually mostly in the ocean, or here where you've got deep subduction, they might be under land, but they're like 100, 200 kilometres deep. I'm actually recently working on a new hazard map for Papua New Guinea, and it's quite interesting. That's actually an extremely high hazard because the subduction zones are actually very close to New Britain, where most countries like, you know, Sumatra, Java, you know, the hazards are high, but the earthquakes actually aren't on land. So it's places like, you know, California and New Zealand where they're on land that you end up with the highest hazards. And so whilst we don't have a lot of earthquakes, in Australia they're all on land and they're all very shallow. So why do we have earthquakes in Australia? The simple answer is this is the Australian Indian tectonic plate. It's drifting north at 60 millimetres a year, and it's been jammed up against the Himalayas up here in the northeast and up against New Zealand in the, northwest, and in New Zealand in the east, and up against sort of New Guinea to the north. And that means the stress fields, Australia is extremely unusual. Actually, even though we're drifting north, the compression is east to west. And so the sort of Perth to Sydney is being squeezed at, we think it's shrinking by about a millimetre a year, but that number's quite difficult to pin down. And so where you get stress, eventually you get a build-up of strain, and you earthquakes as a way of releasing pent-up strain. So that's the simple answer. Exactly how you take that and make an earthquake model is very difficult. So, I mean, most earthquake models, you have some sort of spatial source model of where you think the earthquakes are. Oh, I didn't mean to do that. Most likely to occur, you work out these recurrence rates of, you know, bigger, you know, this is a log scale here, so, you know, you get 10 times as many sixes as you do sevens, and 10 times as many fours as five, et cetera, et cetera. And then, you know, for a specific earthquake, how does that ground shaking attenuate as you move away? And essentially, all an earthquake has a model is a convolution of these three inputs. But as what I'm going to mostly talk about is the fact that, you know, each of these inputs have very large uncertainties attached to them. And so this is an image of the hazard map, which we assume will end up in the building code at some point once the processes go through. They take a while. So these are the primary sources of uncertainty in earthquake hazard maps. I see we've got a bit of table alignment problems here. It's okay. MMACs we think we've pretty much solved in Australia. A colleague of mine, Dan Clark, found all these paleo faults from looking at digital elevation models, and he and I have published a few papers on it. And we've pretty much, our work is being sort of adopted by the US for their models and the Canadians for their hazard maps. And so pretty much in these areas of old stable cratonic crust, we're coming up with sort of maximum earthquakes or maximum credible earthquakes or whatever terminology you want to use of about 7.2 to 7.3. And in these extended areas offshore, the green areas and the grey areas, sort of 6.6 to 6.7. Geologically, this is quite different to the east and west of Australia. Geologically are very different. And so we actually don't have a good the uncertainty on this number is a bit more, but it's still going to be somewhere between 7.3 and 7.6. And this here is three hazard curves, what are called hazard curves. I'll just talk about, so you've got return period here in years. So in this case, I've plotted from zero to 3,000 years. And this is acceleration, spectral acceleration in G, so gravity. So, and this is for Sydney. And so you can see if you choose MMAX, any MMAX between 7 and 7.8 for a probabilistic seismic hazard assessment, it makes very little difference, almost no difference at all at the 500-year return, and even at 3,000, it's not making much difference. It's a big change from the sorts of, 20, 30 years ago, people were using numbers in the 5.5 to 6.5 range, and actually the current US map has numbers down in the low sixes, which... they're probably going to move everything up to high 6-7 in the map they're currently due for release next year or later this year. So we're kind of pretty comfortable. You know, actually, we're not sort of much planning to do much more work on MMAX, because trying to tease out whether it's really 7.4 or 7.5 makes bugger all difference, and we've got better things to work on. Recurrence rates. In theory, they're very simple. You plot up your earthquakes and just do sort of some sort of linear regression, maximum likelihood, least squares, you probably shouldn't use, but it works a lot of the time. The problem is catalogs are not uniform. This is just for Australia, the inputs for the earthquake catalog, all the different agencies that have run seismic networks or reported earthquakes, and every single agency has a slightly different method for locating an earthquake, calculating the magnitude, exactly what they're reporting. And that leads to a lot of uncertainty in. So this is the number report. You know, this is the Richter formula. This is the most simple of the magnitude formulas. There's many others, and we don't actually use Richter very much anymore. But I'm not going to start trying to describe some of the other ones. But the point's the same. Is this is the number you put into this formula, and what you do is Richter came up with a function here, which is basically how waves drop, decrease with distance. And eventually, Australia in the late 80s produced our own. And here I've just subtracted the Richter one, which would come in here from the Australian ones. And you see out at 400K, which isn't, you know, it's a big country. It's pretty, 400, 500Ks is pretty typical to record an earthquake to. The difference between using the Richter formula and an Australian formula is like 0.6. You know, so we're using Richter, we would be overestimating earthquakes by 0.5, 0.5. And so all our old catalog is in Richter. So when you try to adjust for it, you end up with all sorts of kinks and bends in these recurrence forms, because you're basically using three or four at best incompatible catalogs. But because we have so few earthquakes, you need to. So there's a lot of uncertainty in these regression curves. So here you might have, here I've plotted uncertainties in the green just from the statistical uncertainty, but the uncertainty from the magnitudes, which isn't quantified here, would be at least that size again. So you're typically looking at uncertainties in this slope of about 10 to 20%. And so here I've plotted the mean hazard, and then I've down 10, 20, 30%, and then up 10, 20%. And so here you're seeing a 20% change basically results in a doubling or a halving of your earthquake hazard. I'm using, all these are just for Sydney. I've just used the source zone. We have embedded Sydney in, and I'm just playing with the Sydney numbers, but it applies everywhere. So they're just sort of, different people will routinely come up with B values, and so hazard values for Sydney that vary by, sort of the slope varies by at least 0.1 between different researchers, even using the same data, and that's ignoring the problems with the data. And so you routinely see sort of 50% variations in site-specific studies. A group of us are currently working on trying to resolve Adelaide. We're getting variations of factors of 2, 2.5 in Adelaide at the moment from essentially identical data. There's about four people have done different site studies for things like the Adelaide Hospital and that, and we're trying to resolve exactly where those differences are. You've really got to dig into the input models to track them all down. Okay, zonation, it's a very similar story. This is the zone we used for Sydney. And I haven't plotted the earthquakes on here, but you sort of assume they're approximately uniformly distributed. But we actually haven't had any earthquakes in the Sydney Basin. And that could be real, or it could just be, Pisonium random processes. The next 20 years, they'll mostly be in the Sydney Basin. We don't know the answer. We do not have what we call a seismotectonic model that describes Australia. So we really don't know if for some reason the Sydney Basin does not have earthquakes, or it's just the 50 years of observing with it's just spatially, it's a coincidence. We do not know the answer to that. But if you say, and some people do, they say, we don't think Sydney has earthquakes, so so if you moved my source zone from that one and said, I'm going to move Sydney from a high activity source zone to a low activity source zone, it's the brown curve. It drops about 30%. You've got similar discussions in Perth where you've got we'll get onto that in a minute. There's a big tectonic boundary and we draw the border there, but the geologists say, well, actually, we don't think you get any earthquakes within 50K of that fault, so you actually should move your zone away. That would drop the hazard in Perth. Other people argue, well, the fault actually slopes, so you actually could get earthquakes under Perth, even though that'd be 10 or 20K down, so you should actually move it closer to Perth. And so the blue is the sorts of range you'd see from Perth. So again, you're seeing 20, 30%. So I'm just sort of trying to give a flavour. You've got sort of 30% in zonation and 50% from recurrence. And then we get to ground motion models. It gets worse and worse. So a ground motion model is you have an earthquake, and this is recorded data from a magnitude 7 at stations at various distances. And this is from a magnitude 6 at various distances. And I'm pretty sure these are all from one earthquake. So there are two things to note here. The obvious is, as you get a bigger earthquake, you get bigger ground motion models. But the scatter in the data is essentially at least a factor of 2. Just that if you're 10 kilometers away from a magnitude 6, you could have numbers, I can't read this from here, but what's that, about 0.4, you know, ranging up to sort of 0.8 of a G and ranging down to 0.15 of a G. So, you know, these are log scale. So, you know, a log scale, that's a big range. And, you know, people spend a lot of time trying to account for these differences by saying, oh, well, that seismometer was on soft soil and this one was on hard rock and this one was facing the fault zone and this one was perpendicular to the fault zone. But in the end, you always end up with about a factor of 2 or 3 uncertainty in the input data. So various scientists use these sorts of data to come up with what is now called ground motion prediction equations or attenuation function or ground motion models. The terms are all used interchangeably. I guess most non-seismologists, attenuation functions are sort of more, gives you more of a hint of what they are. But the physicists go, it's not attenuation, it's geometrical spreading, so you can't use that term. So, but in Australia, we have virtually no data. So here I've produced hazard curves using, again for Sydney, about a dozen commonly used ground motion prediction equations. All of these have been used in Australia at some point by various studies over the last 20 years. All but some of these really old ones still appear in the literature in various studies. Now, for Australia, the sort of group of experts that got together chose this group of four blue ones here as the ones that we think best represent the eastern half of Australia. But everybody acknowledges that we don't have enough data to actually exclude it. We probably have enough data to exclude it being this really high one, but we really don't have enough data to exclude it being one of these. And again, you change thing, you can double the hazard. So that was all I was going to say on uncertainty, is that, you know, whenever you look at a seismic hazard map, you really need to, you know, it's very much a mean map. It's not a median map, it is a mean map. So those uncertainties are incorporated, but it's a mean map. If you actually looked at the plus one sigma or plus two sigma or minus one minus two sigma, you'd be looking probably about at least a doubling with every sigma, at least a doubling. So now I'm going to talk very briefly on some of the sort of thinking we have on what you might call extreme events. So I'm not actually quite sure what you guys would call an extreme event or a catastrophic risk. And I only got asked to do this talk last Thursday, so I haven't had a lot of time to talk about what, but that's life. So here's some modelling Geoscience Australia did several years ago now. So this is a little known fault under Melbourne, modelling a 6.4. So you end up, this is coloured on, this one's percentage of building damage, and this is a 7.5. So in this case, the 7.5 is along this long fault, so most of the earthquake, you know, about half of it's offshore, and then half the loss area is in here in Port Phillip Bay where there's nothing to hurt. So, you know, they were trying to do realistic models in this case, but, you know, if you're looking at extreme events, you go, well, we've got no evidence there's not some big fault under here, in which case, you know, this whole, you could make all of Melbourne red by putting them on unknown faults rather than putting them on known faults. So, my understanding is these are the sorts of numbers of so these are the models out of Sydney, the sorts of injuries, major injuries, deaths. To me, I think these numbers here are on the upper end. I suspect whoever's done this modelling's made some assumptions about sort of worse. With deaths in particular, not so much injuries or certainly not damage to buildings, but deaths, time of day really matters. You know, if everybody's snug at home, they're generally safer than, like Newcastle, the workers' club the second story of the workers' club completely collapsed onto the bottom story, and there was only three people in the workers' club at the time, and two of them died, and one of them was seriously injured. If it had been 7 o'clock on Friday night and there had been 500 people in the workers' club, we might have a very different perception about earthquake potential loss in Australia. So I think these deaths, they've sort of picked the worst time of day when they've done it. So again, huge uncertainties amongst all of these sorts of behaviours.
5 minutes.
Okay. So I've kind of made some estimates that I would think a catastrophic event, whatever that means, which probably means something to you but not to me, is I've said, well, that's probably a bigger than magnitude 6.8 under a city, or bigger than a 7.1 next to a city was my logic. Maybe I should have asked Will the answer. He probably could have told me off the top of his head. So these are the sorts of recurrence rates we expect for those sorts of earthquakes across various cities. And again, just remember we're talking factors of about two or three here. So, you know, Sydney, I'm saying 15,000 years for a magnitude 7, but, you know, the one sigma uncertainty be, you know, 6,000 to 30, 40,000, something like that. But these are the values that just come out of doing those, extrapolating those recurrence curves from magnitude 3.5, where you have good data, out to, and assuming my B value is perfect, which they never are. Big earthquakes require big faults. You cannot have a big earthquake without a big fault. Earthquake scale. So if you want a magnitude 7 earthquake, you need a fault of 40 kilometres long fault. If you want a sort of 7.4, you've got to find yourself a 60 kilometre long fault. If you want a 6, it's easy. 10 kilometres, there could be 20 10 kilometre faults under Sydney we'd never know about. But the really big faults we'd probably know about. So if you look at Adelaide, we know these are the well-identified faults. All of these faults are pretty, the neotectonicists, are pretty sure that there's been earthquakes on these, all of these faults in the last couple of 100,000 years. From a geological point of view, we consider any fault that's had a big earthquake in the last million years to be potentially active, because from a geological point of view, that's when the stress field of Australia, when all those collisions I talked about at the beginning, there's been no more change in that plate boundary in about the last 4 million years. So you allow a couple of million years for everything to rejig to the new stress orientation, and you say any fault that's gone off in the last 1 to 2 million years has gone off under the current stress field. All the perturbations have died out, so it's probably quite capable of going off again. So Adelaide has lots. You could get sevens right under Adelaide, right next through the middle of the southern suburbs. There's another fault on the edge, and these are only 50k away. So you might remember those ground motion equations. They didn't drop it off at all for about 10k, and they only start dropping off pretty slowly to 50. Then after about 50 or 100, they drop off quickly. So any of these faults here could really hammer Adelaide. Melbourne, again, you've got some underneath it, but most of the damage would likely come from these big ones that sort of bound greater Melbourne. But again, you know, there's a lot of sediments in here. There could be some faults in here, but the geologists tell me they don't think there's any really big 50 kilometre long faults hidden under here. There's probably lots of 10, 20 kilometre long faults that could host sixes. But if you're worried about the high sixes and sevens, it's probably only on these big bounding faults. So again, they're sort of on the edge of Melbourne, not directly under Melbourne. Perth seems to get even better. I'd always assume this Darling Fault was active and you could have a whopper in here. Increasingly, the geologists can't find any evidence for major earthquakes on this. Not sure if any of you know Perth, but this is a big fault. India used to be attached to Australia here. And this is what happened when it pulled apart. There's big faults here and lots offshore as things wrenched apart about 65 million years ago. But it would appear the big earthquakes here, the Meckering that, you know, completely destroyed the town of Meckering in 67, they're the big earthquakes, but they don't appear to be under Perth. And you sort of arrive at the same story for Sydney. The geotechnical engineers say there's been so many cuttings and tunnels and stuff in Sydney. If there was a fault that was 50 kilometres long with a slip on it of 2 metres, you'd probably see it somewhere in Sydney. You don't have a lot of soil in Sydney. It's all that hard Sydney landstone. It would preserve, the geologists tell me, it would preserve a fault on the surface for at least 50,000 years. So we think all the earthquakes are here up to the what's called the Lapsden monocline. So, you know, the foot of the Blue Mountains. So the big earthquakes in Sydney, the 6.7s and above, we think are probably going to sit here. And so, again, they're away fair distance from the CBD. So return periods, as I was saying, very uncertain. This is the numbers I've been using, but this is your 1 and 2 sigma uncertainty in your return period. So if you're trying to do return periods of catastrophic earthquakes, it's on individual faults. It's the uncertainties are very, very large. So conclusion, there's high uncertainty in the Australian earthquake hazard map. The plus or minus 1 sigma is about a factor of 2. In places it'll be a factor of 3. And that's what we observe in site-specific studies. Large earthquakes basically could occur, you know, the 6.3, 6.5 could occur pretty much under any Australian city with a return periods of the order of this sort of 5,000, except Hobart. Hobart appears to be much more aseismic. Catastrophic earthquakes can occur near most cities, but actually it's probably only Adelaide and Melbourne they're going to occur directly under. Thank you. I think I was only a bit over time.
Thank you, Mark. We might have just time for one question, and then at the end of these three, I'm going to get the speakers to sit up and take a couple more questions if we have any extra time before the coffee break. Does anyone have a pressing, Elaine? While the mic's coming, I'll just point out we call those realistic disaster scenarios, is the insurance terminology okay. For it.
Thank you, Mark, for that presentation. It's Elaine Collins. My question was really around the Richter scale. I didn't realise that they weren't using it anymore. So I'm assuming now when we see the magnitude of an earthquake, it's not actually the Richter scale, it's the new scale. So I'm interested in where that new scale came in, and is that correct, that we only see this new scale, and why a new scale was developed anyway, and does it also not take into account depth, only magnitude? Thank you.
There are about a dozen earthquake scales. But when people have developed them, they've tied them to, so in the magnitude 5 to 6.5 range, all the magnitude scales have been tied to Richter. You know, when you do your maths, in the end, the actual final number is sort of a constant, and so they fix them. So I still tend to accept the term Richter scale when I'm talking to the media and stuff, even though technically we don't tend to use it. And the Richter scale applies really to that formula as applied to the California. You know, when we use it for Australia, it's not technically the Richter scale, it's the Richter methodology applied to Australian geology. But as I said, when people invent a new Richter scale, new magnitude scale, we tie it to Richter for consistency. And all magnitude scales take into account depth. That A0 term is a depth-dependent term. Depending on which scale you are, they're all two, three, four dimensional things. They're not single lines, even though I just plotted a single line.
Okay.
We have one more.
Okay, real quick.
Green's very keen.
How did you go the latest budget round for funding, and what are the implications for Geoscience Australia?
Well, like most public service agencies, Geoscience Australia's taken about a 15% staff hit. 10, 15, so we've just, over the last 6 months, have sort of had about a 10% redundancy. So for us, that means the person who did all the work on our ground motion prediction equations, he actually resigned and moved to Canada about a year ago, and that job hasn't been backfilled, and there's no sign of it being backfilled. So we haven't had any cuts. The program hasn't been cut, but what's happened is as people are moving on, they're not being backfilled. So, yeah, the sort of research end into new ground motion equations and stuff is not as strong as it was a few years ago.
Okay, that's a bit of a concern. It's possibly our peril with the largest consequences. Please join me in thanking Mark.
Thank you.
I'll see you.